Welcome to the Second Thought for the Day podcast. We fill that rather niche spot for anyone who has ever been even mildly irritated by Thought for the Day on Radio 4 and wondered why no one was doing anything about it or even holding them to account. This is a throwback episode. We revisit an earlier review. We knew when we started that we'd likely make the odd mistake, and in the spirit of keeping an open mind, we went back through the feedback we had to see what leads there were for further consideration. We found one. The first one. The first thought for the day that we reviewed was presented by Angela Tilby. Tilby is a retired Anglican priest in Oxford. There was much wrong with her contribution that day, the 10th of April. There was, though, a niggling doubt at second thought, shared by one or two of those who'd been kind enough to provide feedback, that we'd perhaps been a touch harsh in our criticism of Angela's account of how theology of marriage was brought out of the Dark Ages by an English archbishop. Now, let's be clear, it wasn't. This archbishop made several important changes, but the vows and the theology behind them were for the most part unchanged. At least they were in all the ways that are relevant to what Tilby said. The doubt we had centered on whether or not we'd taken too general an approach to dismissing Angela Tilby's claim that Cranmer had revolutionized the theory of marriage, when perhaps Tilby was just making a point more focused on the words of the ceremony. Here's what we said at the time. We were led to believe that medieval clerics in England saw marriage as somewhat removed from the church and little more than a contractual means of reigning in fornication and enforcing social order. We're then invited to contrast this dark spell of matrimonial theology with the Enlightenment that accompanied the first English prayer book of 1549. The prevailing requisites of fornication abatement and societal control were there, but now accompanied for the first time by a suggestion that those getting married should love and cherish each other. Quite frankly, rubbish. I'm not an expert, but there's a lot of straightforward and verifiable information out there for anyone with 20 minutes to spare and a passing familiarity with the internet. For the vast majority of Christian history before 1549 in England, direction for the church was provided exclusively by Rome, and marriage had long been considered by the Roman Church to be an act of divine significance, at least since a thing called the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215. Since then, marriage was understood to be a reflection of the union between the church and Christ. Of some importance, love and cherishment had been somewhat obviously front and centre in marriage since long, long before the scribblings of an English archbishop in 1549 were turned into a prayer book. So, we set about fact-checking her and us. And what we discovered was astonishing. Tilby had been much worse than we'd appreciated at the time. It was clear that our criticism of her claims about Cranmer were not only justified, but spectacularly incomplete. That said, our comments on Tilby's claim about the use of love and cherish was slightly off. We'd conflated the content of the vows with the content of Cranmer's little sermon on why marriage was ordained by God. In our defence, Tilby started that, but we remain thankful this error made no material difference. Everything else we criticised was bang on. On to those that we missed. These were all in a relatively short section on how Tilby described the changes to the marriage ceremony in England in the 1500s.
In the theology of the Middle Ages, marriage was a kind of contract, a way of ordering society and holding lust in check.
It was. It still is. As far as the church is concerned, nothing here has changed. Tilby's implication that it has is false.
Marriages took place in the church porch, as if they were half-worldly and pragmatic, half-holy.
Vows were indeed exchanged in the porch, but to suggest this diluted their holiness is groundless speculation. Indeed, Tilby, on this point, could hardly be more wrong.
In the first English prayer book of 1549, a more positive view was stated.
No, it was not. Tilby here makes a veiled false claim that there was something negative about the porch vow pre-Cranmer marriage service.
The ceremony was brought into the body of the church.
It was, but not because Cranmer thought this would make weddings more holy.
And was now accompanied by a compulsory little sermon on why God had ordained marriage.
Cranmer's prayer book made a significant addition to one of the wedding vows on the God-ordained estate of holy matrimony, so some sort of exposition in the service itself was likely felt necessary.
Three reasons were given. First, to provide for the procreation of children and to ensure they were brought up in the fear of the Lord. Second, for the avoidance of the sin of fornication, sex outside marriage.
So far, so good.
But then Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury who drafted the new service, added something quite new. Marriage was instituted for the mutual society, help and comfort that the one ought to have of the other, both in prosperity and adversity.
Except this was not new. It had been in the vows themselves for centuries. The new bit from Cranmer came next, but inexplicably, Tilby left it out. She went straight on to be wrong about something else.
Cranmer also added the words to love and to cherish to the marriage vows.
Technically, it could be argued, this is correct, but to do so would obscure the truth of the changes Cranmer made. Love and cherish were very much part of the wedding rite long before 1549.
The historian Dermot McCulloch suggests that we owe these additions to Cranmer's own happy experience of marriage.
No. While the experience of Cranmer's two marriages almost certainly informed his approach to the revision of this service, the statement from Tilby is misleading. Apparently, deliberately so. It is true to say that it's possible to infer a suggestion from McCulloch on what Cranmer drew from his own experience of marriage. It is not true to say that McCulloch made this suggestion. We never imagined that we'd have to read a biography of a dead bishop to fact-check a retired priest. Life is full of surprises. It is, though, an excellent book. The Canon Tilby can barely type without unjustifiable speculation and blatant falsehoods filling the pages. In fewer than 200 words, Tilby manages to stuff a cavalcade of errors that we didn't spot the first time around. Let's take each in turn. Tilby's presentation of a 1549 enlightenment in matrimonial theology is a simple straw man fallacy. The contrast that she describes between the Middle Ages and what came later does not exist, at least not as Tilby presents it. Attacking one side or other of an invented comparison is cowardly and dishonest. We should, though, pause for a second on straw man. From experience, it's one of the least well understood of the common logical fallacies. Oddly, humans, at least several large subsets of humans, appear to have a natural ability to use a straw man fallacy to their advantage, despite no knowledge of what it is. Rather than tackle the subject of a discussion, someone using a straw man will project an invented alternative discussion on the other person as though they'd said it, and then attack the projection instead. They stand up, and then they knock down the straw man, leaving the relevant subject well alone. For example, someone says, blue is cool, and the person they're talking to says, why do you hate red? The subject here, established by the first person, is blue and its alleged coolness, but instead of engaging with that subject, the respondent creates a fake subject, the straw man, which is the hatred of red, which is then used to make an irrelevant and groundless allegation about the first person. Now clearly, no one's actually arguing about red and blue. More common straw man arguments are similar to these examples. Politician 1. We have a problem that can only be solved by giving our schools more resources for art and for music. Politician 2. This is outrageous. My opponent wants to undermine our schools by defunding maths and science. Politician A. We must cut carbon emissions to prevent a climate catastrophe. Politician B. There is no way our economy can support the immediate banning of petrol and diesel cars. Using a straw man argument is an inherently dishonest act. There is an implicit acknowledgement in every example that the user does not have the arguments or perhaps the skill to tackle the actual subject. So rather than capitulate or acknowledge the merits of the other side, they frustrate understanding, they derail the debate, and they start a battle against reason. Another form uses the straw man to advance a fallacious position. For example, we've known for decades that camembert causes heart disease. It's important to note that Edam was not involved in any of those studies of camembert, and it has not been implicated as a hair loss cheese. Perhaps now we can live as hairy Edam cheese eaters in the comfort of this knowledge. Presumably, a representative of the Dutch dairy industry thinks that she can sway the camembert eaters to try Edam. So she opens with a plausible but false assertion, and then she leans on the consequences of this falsehood while adding others to promote a different cheese. This, if you'll forgive the cheese, is precisely what Tilby does. Her straw man is the dark theology of the Middle Ages, which she contrasts with a positive change brought about by a prayer book. In fairness, this change did somewhat neatly coincide with the end of the Middle Ages, as it's usually understood, but this is a correlation, not a causation, and more pertinently, the contrast Tilby is claiming simply doesn't exist. It is an invention to promote Archbishop Cranmer, his prayer book, and an awful lot of other Anglican stuff. Tilby casts the Middle Ages as the before and as inferior. Specifically, it's the theology of the Middle Ages on which Tilby throws shade. The contrast, if there is one, is not between the theology of the Middle Ages and what came from Cranmer. The contrast is between the established doctrine of the Church of Rome and the Reformation ideas that were bubbling across Northern Europe. Tilby is simply slinging mud at Catholicism, notably without any justification. Now, in England, these Reformation ideas were given a significant constitutional lift when the Pope told Henry VIII that his marriage to Catherine of Aragon would not be annulled. Now, Henry was in need of an heir, and for that, he was in need of a wife, a new wife, and hence a new church, one that would not be subject to the whims of a pope. Cranmer, the reformer, was hired as archbishop, and this new archbishop clearly saw his chance and took it. Back to Angela. She suggested that pre-Reformation marriage was inferior, merely a contract to order society and to keep lust in check. Apparently, marriages were also then insufficiently godly. Now, this godliness deficit is something that Angela quite incorrectly inferred from pre-Reformation vows being exchanged at the church door before the ceremony moved inside. This happened for two reasons, one practical and one symbolic. The practical reason was so that the exchanging of the vows was public. Those outside and inside the church would hear the vows, and all would have an opportunity before the making of those vows to raise an impediment, and thus making themselves enormously popular with the bride and the groom and whomever was paying for the reception. It had nothing to do with Angela Tilby's muddled musings on the half-holiness of medieval marriages and inappropriate use of the word pragmatic. On to the symbolic. Now, somewhat obviously, the church doors symbolized the threshold between the secular and the sacred. Once the vows were made, the couple would cross the threshold into the sacred space of the church from the secular exterior, while also entering the holy sacrament of marriage. Thresholds appear elsewhere in marriage traditions. These, though, hinge on folklore that thresholds were inhabited by evil spirits. Weirder still, that the soles of the feet of women were somehow vulnerable to these spirits. Hence, the groom would carry the bride over the threshold of the matrimonial home to prevent the bride from becoming possessed through her feet. Men's feet presumably featured some natural spirit repellent, and as far-fetched as it all sounds, I'm sure there are many brides who will testify to the repellent nature of their husband's feet.
In the first English prayer book of 1549, a more positive view was stated. Ceremony was brought into the body of the church and was now accompanied by a compulsory little sermon on why God had ordained marriage.
Angela's claim that this new prayer book gave a more positive view is hogwash. And as we've seen, her attempt to justify this claim by the change in location for the vows only compounds that falsehood. Several of Angela's errors appear rooted in an approach to research that never ventured beyond Wikipedia. So first, some background. The revision to marriage on which Tilby was commenting was called the Solemnization of Matrimony, part of this 1549 prayer book. The service described in the new prayer book, though, was in substantial part simply a translation of its predecessor from Latin to English. Now, that predecessor was the order for the consecration of marriage in a thing called the Sarum Rite, which was the prevailing church manual of the time. Sarum denoted Salisbury, which was the diocese in which the most widely adopted manual was developed. The Sarum Rite was in Latin, but it instructed the priest to conduct the marriage in his mother tongue. The Sarum Rite was very similar to the rite on which it was based of the Church of Rome. Now, Cranmer was an enthusiastic Protestant reformer. This enthusiasm infused an extensive operation to anglicise the church in England under his direction as archbishop. Reformers put emphasis on accessibility and understanding. English was favoured over Latin. Congregational participation was encouraged, with much less prominence for ritual, for the centrality of the priest and the altar. It was the end of the road in this English church for Roman concepts such as purgatory, penance, and the veneration of the saints. Another major casualty was a concept represented by the truly wonderful word, transubstantiation. This was the Roman church belief that the ceremonial bread and wine of communion was the actual flesh and blood of Jesus, meaning that Christ's body and blood were, for believers, physically present and eaten during the ceremony. Cranmer and his Protestant reformer allies had a much less permissive approach to sacraments than the Romans. They held that only baptism and something called the Eucharist would remain as sacraments. Before having read about this to understand just how willing Angela Tilby was to deceive the audience of Radio 4, I had little idea of what a sacrament was. I now have a little more and rather wish I didn't. There are much better things with which to fill a mind. In any event, the Roman Church has 7 sacraments. This revision down to 2 by Cranmer was quite a hefty cut. His prayer book saw to it that marriage was demoted from this lofty holiness. Now, contrary to Tilby's intimation, the prayer book, it could be argued, objectively reduced the holiness of the marriage ceremony. Never mind her confusion over church porches. For this fall from sacramental grace, though, marriage was given something of a parachute. Cranmer may not have believed in marriage as a sacrament, but he did believe that it was ordained by God and that it constituted something called a holy estate. So having whipped off the stripes of sacrament, the archbishop felt obliged to make up the difference, and he did this with a new vow. Technically, it was an addition to one of the existing 5 vows. But this addition obliged the couple getting married to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony. So let's focus for a second on these vows. The original vows of Rome and Salisbury can be separated into 5 sections. You could broadly say there were 5 vows. Important to note, there were other manuals and many variations in the Latin word choice and translation. Broadly, though, there was consensus, and the 5 sections of the Latin vows were in order. At number 1, consent. Number 2, cherishment. Number 3, constancy. Number 4, commitment. And number 5, ceaselessness. Now, on our website, secondthoughtfortheday.com, the Latin is reproduced next to each of the vows that we're just going to run through. So first, consent. Do you wish to have this man stroke woman as your groom stroke bride? Next came cherishment. The cherishment vow features a notorious difference between that for the bride and that for the groom. Instead of vowing to love, honour, hold and protect, the bride was saddled with having to obey, serve, love, honour and protect. It's also worth noting the love in this cherishment section of the vows. The Latin word used here was diligere, which I've almost certainly not pronounced correctly. But it means much more than having affection, and it's not Christian love, it's not erotic love. Of particular relevance, it meant an expression of love demonstrated by having committed to a choice. The object of your affection is dignified by your choice to love it. The word is also often translated as esteem and worship, alongside cherish and various others. We then have the constancy vow, familiar to everyone, in sickness and in health. The commitment section had 2 parts, and this is important because this is one of the sections that Tilby claims was brand new in that little sermon she mentioned. And it's the bit that demands that the bride and the groom each be to each other as they ought to be. And then the second was the familiar forsaking of all others. In fairness, Cranmer did expand a little with a couple of explanations of what being to the other what you ought to be involved. The way he put it was for mutual society help and comfort. I guess that might be necessary if the bride and groom weren't aware of how they ought to behave towards one another in a marriage. And then finally we have ceaselessness, and stay with him or her for as long as you both shall live. Now, the prayer book added to these vows. The new bit joined the consent vow right at the top, which became, using the 1549 wording, "Wilt thou have this man to be thy wedded husband, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony?" Now, there was no explanation in the Sarum rite of the wedding service on why God ordained marriage, although you could reasonably infer from Tilby's account that there was, but it wasn't as though there was no understanding among priests in their congregations of the reasons that God did ordain marriage. It's simply that this understanding didn't get a mandatory plug in the order of service. But since Cranmer has made this ordination an addition to an actual vow, you can understand his motivation to sex up the order with some well-placed explanatory notes. And it was the third reason included in the explanatory notes of God's ordination in the new prayer book that Tilby claimed was quite new. And this is how it appears in the 1549 original. "Thirdly, for the mutual society, help and comfort that the one ought to have of the other, both in prosperity and adversity, into the holy estate these two persons present come now to be joined." The mutual society, mutual help and mutual comfort that the one ought to have of the other simply spells out what is already in the commitment section of the Sarum Rite vows, as a bride ought to be to her groom, and as a groom ought to be to his bride. Then we have a pre-run of the constancy section of the Sarum Rite vow, but health becomes prosperity and sickness becomes adversity. The genuinely new section is, "into the holy estate these two people now come to be joined." Tilby fails to include this new bit in her commentary about new bits, while also including old bits and claiming them to be new. That's quite a feat. It does provide an excellent illustration of how quickly the truth can suffer when confronted with a scarcity of curiosity and an abundance of faith. The presenters, particularly the Christian presenters of Thought for the Day, quite frequently mention truth and its seeking, yet they demonstrate repeatedly a lack of curiosity for the truth and an abundance of faith that gets in the way of them exploring it. For now, back to Angela and her comments on love and cherish.
Cranmer also added the words "to love and to cherish" to the marriage vows.
Love had long been in the vows. Cherish, esteem, worship also feature in various translations of the various Latin church manuals. It wasn't that Cranmer added love and cherish. What Cranmer did was remove opportunity for interpretation by the priest that inevitably accompanied extemporaneous translation of the Latin into English. It was Cranmer's view that love and cherish was appropriate as the translation to be in the first formal English order of the marriage service. He most certainly wasn't adding anything different. In Tilby's defence, the Wikipedia page on the Book of Common Prayer does say in the final sentence of its section about marriage, Cranmer added the words "to love and cherish." This seems like an excellent advertisement for not restricting your research exclusively to Wikipedia. The claim that Cranmer added love and cherish to the wedding vows is at best an oversimplification, and at worst false, concealing the truth behind those changes. Finally, we have the comments on the happy marriage of Cranmer and how this influenced his approach to the revised service in his prayer book. The historian Tilby cites, Mr. McCulloch, did not pass judgment on the happiness of Cranmer's marriages. Cranmer had two wives, perhaps making him uniquely qualified as a bishop of his epoch for the revising of wedding services. His marriage experience might best, though, be described as checkered. Dates and details are sketchy, but it seems likely his first wife died in childbirth within 3 years of the two of them having met. There is no evidence of Cranmer ever having commented or written about this experience, which was no doubt painful for him. Although this takes nothing away from the esteem Cranmer may or may not have held for this marriage. His second marriage was quite different and took place almost entirely in secret, not just the wedding, the whole marriage, and featured long periods of separation. This was the result of him having ignored his vows of clerical celibacy, so perhaps not the ideal arbiter of vows. Then he was promoted to archbishop, which forced him to return to England from continental Europe. Keeping his wife and daughter secret was, in the words of McCulloch, astonishing. Cranmer clearly valued marriage. It was certainly difficult to keep him from doing it. But there is no record of him ever having commented on the happiness or otherwise of these marriages. It seems likely that his second marriage did inform how he approached his tweaks to the wedding ceremony when preparing a new English manual for all churches in England. So in summary, following our fact check to ensure we'd not been too harsh on Tilby, we instead found that she'd made many more errors than we'd originally found. She'd used a straw man argument to produce an invented contrast between the theology of marriages before and after the Middle Ages. She intimated that pre-prayer book marriage was less holy, which is a direct inversion of the truth. She suggested that pre-Cranmer marriage was merely contractual lust control, when, as we pointed out in our original broadcast on this, the Sarum Rite marriage had long been regarded as a divine act. What we hadn't realised at the time was that marriage before Cranmer had been a holy sacrament. Thomas effectively demoted its holiness. Tilby then falsely claimed that the third reason for God ordination of marriage in the service sermon was completely new, when it had in fact been in the service for hundreds of years. And she finished off by misrepresenting both a historian and the history of love and cherish in marriage vows. Here's how we concluded the original review of Tilby's broadcast. What a wasted opportunity and a pointless effort. And that's before we consider the barbs. Just rubbish. Rubbish indeed. Tilby is deceitful. She manipulates her sources. She makes dozens of false claims. This truly is an appalling broadcast, and the more we look at it, the worse it becomes. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to learn more about what we do and why, or to read show notes, find transcripts, or listen to any of the other podcasts that we've not yet put out on the main feed, please visit secondthoughtfortheday.com.